I'm George Cole for Yellowstone Public Radio. Scott Simon is host of Weekend Edition Saturday on National Public Radio, and Scott is my guest today. Simon joined NPR in 1977 as chief of NPR's Chicago Bureau. Since moving to D.C., Scott Simon has reported from all 50 states, covered 9 wars, and has reported from Central America, Africa, India, the Caribbean, and several spots in the Middle East, most recently Baghdad. In 1989, he won the George Foster Peabody Award for his weekly radio essays. Simon is the son of a comedian and actress, and he grew up in many towns, including Chicago, New York, San Francisco, L.A., Montreal, Cleveland, and Washington, D.C. Simon attended the University of Chicago and McGill University, and Scott Simon has won numerous journalistic awards. The interview with Scott was recorded June 14th at NPR in Washington, D.C. Scott, as we record this interview, you've just recently returned from Baghdad, 2 or 3 weeks out, and tell me your observations. I know that military conflict and covering wars is nothing new to you, but on the other hand, perhaps this was a different type of experience. What did you see? What did you hear?
You know, well, every experience is different. I must say, I covered the military junta in El Salvador in that conflict. I covered the Mengistu regime in Ethiopia in that conflict. I covered Sarajevo when it was under siege in that conflict. And all of that being noted, I think Saddam Hussein's regime wins its own special low place.
Really?
In the pantheon
low
of low place in the pantheon of tyrannies.
And why is that?
The brutality was pervasive in that society in all senses, pervasive and effective. We did a story using some Ba'ath Party secret documents, which I think were a pretty good window on that, in which you understood. There was a quote we were able to unearth from an interview that Saddam Hussein gave in 1979, shortly after he came to power, to Ephraim Karsh, the British scholar, in which he said, in more or less these words, I know people are trying to kill me. I expect that. But the big advantage I have is that I know who is capable of killing me even before they do, and I go after them first. And you got to understand that in the Ba'ath Party documents. We went to Al-Hakamaya prison, which was one of the more notorious political prisons, just as it had been liberated. And this was a place in which 1,100, 1,500 inmates were held, of which all of them at one time or another were tortured. About a quarter of them at any given time were executed and put in mass graves outside of the prison. And I guess even I, having been around, thought of political prisoners as people who had signed a petition, participated in a demonstration, written a letter to a newspaper, done something to bring them to the attention of the regime. But this was not even the case in Iraq. That's why the world, you didn't see pictures on CNN or Al Jazeera of that regime breaking up mass demonstrations, as we're seeing as you and I sit here, that the regime in Tehran is doing. People were thrown into prison if they were standing on a street corner and somebody 50 feet away told a joke about Saddam Hussein, and they didn't interrupt them. If you had a distant cousin who escaped over the border into Jordan, you would be arrested, because the regime figured that made you vulnerable to, at one point, turning against the regime. Hundreds of thousands of people were thrown into prison that way, and it was, to coin a phrase, utterly mind-boggling to understand the extent to which this regime inhabited and twisted the lives of
these thousands and thousands of people. Have they been freed, killed, a combination of both, maimed?
A good proportion that I think will take years to determine have in fact been tortured and or killed. Some lucky several thousand who were in the prisons at the time U.S. and British forces came through have been liberated. But even there, there's some despicable stories. We went to a place that's called in English, incongruously House of Mercy, which was a home in what had been called Saddam City, a very poor neighborhood in Baghdad, that was a home for street kids, kids who'd been abandoned by their families in their late teens and early adolescence. And these youngsters were routinely beaten, tortured, mutilated, raped, both boys and girls. By people working at the house who were not in any way professionals at working with youngsters. They were bath party jobs. They got a steady income, which didn't prevent them, it must be said, from they would contact agencies like Enfants du Monde, which is for the most part a very good agency in France that works with children around the world, or UNICEF, and make a pretty convincing case as to why they needed certain kinds of equipment. The equipment would get delivered and the staff members would steal it and fence it on the black market or escape with it when the war began. And so when U.S. forces came to this place, which the House of Mercy, they noticed youngsters who were, it must be said, were not that much younger than the soldiers, because we're talking about some kids who were 17 and 18, let's say the soldiers are 18 and 19, and they saw people of about their age who had clearly been beaten and tortured and living behind cages, and the U.S. soldiers just opened the place up and the kids escaped. Regrettably, they ran into a neighborhood where many of the youngsters were beaten and raped, and that was another ugly story all over again. Now I must say my last information is the home is trying to put itself back under much more decent auspices.
You know, Scott Simon, as the story continues to unfold, I want to broaden the conversation a bit. The new term embedded reporters, and I don't know if when you were there, whether you were embedded or not.
I was what they call a unilateral.
A unilateral.
Or unis.
Independent.
Didn't
on
like
their
the
own?
Sound of that. Yes. Independent. Yeah. Well, not independent in the sense of working for NPR, but not attached to any military unit.
As a journalist, what is your philosophy, toward how the Pentagon handled this war and, the term of embedded,
How they handled the
coverage of the war.
Embedding of reporters.
Yes, yes.
I think people can second guess and talk about the effect of embedding, was I think certainly many reporters who were stationed with units, because you wind up identifying your own safety with that of the unit.
For good reason.
And their success with, translates as your survival. Obviously, the argument can be made that some of the coverage was skewed toward the side of the military effort, and that's true. And yet, the reports were live from the field. They were utterly uncensored. There's something that says something extraordinary about our society that way, because I think of a lot of the uncensored reporting inevitably was not the kind of thing that under ordinary circumstances the Pentagon would have liked. I mean, I remember reading a piece in the International Herald Tribune that originated obviously in the New York Times, in which a young soldier who having known a lot of young soldiers, I'm sure it didn't mean to sound insensitive, said something like, yeah, the old lady got in our way and we smoked her. Mm-hmm. I think years from now, maybe even now, seeing that quote in black and white will cause him pain and make him seem like some kind of ogre. Whereas I think that the fact that's probably closer to the truth is he wasn't an ogre at all so much as he was a scared kid who got overexcited in the heat of battle. And the fact that U.S. military strategy could be second-guessed by the reporters who were traveling with those very soldiers. There's something extraordinary about that. And I don't think there's any way back on this. I mean, we cannot in the news industry. People like me assailed the Pentagon for years, saying you have to let us closer to what's actually going on. And then when they do, complain about it. I mean, if we want, I suppose we can buy our own tanks and venture out into the field of battle, but obviously I think we'd probably be identified as unidentifiable and destroyed. So I think there's no way around, and I don't think there's any shame in traveling with soldiers on either side. You just have to be certain as to remain a kind of open, honest reporter.
Well, I'm glad I asked you the question. That clears up a lot of that for me as a pedestrian, listening and watching and reading about what is happening over there. As we speak, David Brinkley recently died, and perhaps the most cryptic user of the declarative sentence, certainly in broadcast journalism, if not the English language. David Brinkley, to me, represents an era in especially television journalism that harkens back to the 60s and early 70s. And Scott Simon, I'd like you to reflect on where broadcast journalism specifically has gone, and given the David Brinkley, Chet Hundley legacy, where are we at as far as your profession?
You know, it's interesting. When I was I was very very young when I saw what turned out to be the tail end of the Huntley-Brinkley report. I barely remember that. I mean, I so much as I remember my father imitating it in succeeding years. You know, good night, David. Good night, Chet. And good night for NBC News, that sort of thing. But I think we can pretty fairly say that those were in the days in which news departments were not expected to make money. Entertainment divisions were expected to make lots and lots of money. But it was considered to be a public service to run a news division. And, they would consciously lose money. And I think it has to be said that they had a kind of more serious approach to choosing stories, selecting what stories they would follow up on without regards to what they thought were popular whim. Honestly, it was more a part of the news business. Now I think there's still a lot of good work being done. I don't want to necessarily say that, that everything has gone downhill, because I think there's a lot of outstanding work, which, to be fair, would not be possible without the enormous profits that have been reaped by some news divisions, not at the moment so much, but some news divisions in recent years. But that being said, inevitably, you find a lot more junk news. Not just an occasional piece over why are people watching American Idol, but this whole nonsense of making prolonged news stories into the people who are contestants on American Idol. And I certainly hope the listeners of Montana Public Radio will be honest enough to acknowledge that they know what I'm talking about, and not turn around from
the
radio set and say,
obviously, they never go there. Right.
Right. And that sort of stuff, which I don't want to say has no place in the interests of human beings, but I think it does clot up too much time where the news is concerned. Now, look, I don't complain about this too much, because I think both the people who work in the industry and the people who consume it can vote with their feet or their fingers.
That's true. There are so many on radio and television both, and on the newsstand, so many options.
Yeah, and I think it also must be said that this is one of the forces that has enabled National Public Radio to thrive, to have an
Indeed.
Audience that now exceeds 25 million people, because they're people who want something different. And when I say something more serious, I hope that doesn't sound stultifying, because the fact is we have a sense of humor. You know, I think I've sometimes been quoted over the years as saying sometimes the NPR sense of humor will be a joke that begins, man walks into a bar and he slips on a kiwi fruit peel. but in any event, I think it's often a good deal better than that. And we do shows and have segments of shows that are strictly for fun, that we're not trying to educate or even enlighten anybody. But the fact is, at the end of the day, we have the largest broadcast news organization in the United States at this point, with reporters that are flung all over the world. And I think every American has understood over the past year and a half and 2 years how important it is to have people in place all over the world when world events beckon.
I want to return to the NPR news cycle in just a moment. I'm talking to Scott Simon of National Public Radio, and we're in one of the studios at NPR in Washington, D.C. Scott is also a writer. His most recent book, Jackie Robinson and the Integration of Baseball, which is published by Wiley. And Scott, as I read this book, I found it not only compelling to read, but a very civil discussion between something that happens very often in our culture, even today, the manliness and womanliness of sport, but also its relationship to race and race relations in the United States. And talk to us a bit about why Jackie Robinson represented the cutting force here in the integration of sport and baseball specifically.
You know, it's interesting, because as I say in the book, when I began the book shortly before September 11th occurred, And then when the events of September 11th intervened, for the one thing, my responsibilities in daily news coverage obviously increased terrifically, but for a few weeks I kind of lost the thread. I felt funny about doing a book in which an athlete would be acclaimed by some people as a hero, because it seems to me that we saw heroes on September 11th, and they were wearing uniforms, but they were not Brooklyn Dodger uniforms or Yankees uniforms, or if I may, even Chicago Cub uniforms. They were the, you know, the blue.
A recurring theme in your broadcast.
I guess it is, absolutely. I beg your pardon, but only a little. They were the blue uniforms of emergency workers. And yet, as I, because I had a book contract, as I became more deeply involved in the story, I mean, I intellectually knew who Jackie Robinson was, and emotionally, but I mean, as I researched the story in the way you have to write a book, I came back to the fact that Jackie Robinson was, by any definition, a hero. He offered his life for a noble purpose. In fact, even risked his life, arguably, for a noble purpose. It's difficult for us to understand, thank God, in the United States today, that when he was signed to a major league contract by Branch Rickey in 1945, when ships were steaming home from Europe and the Pacific for soldiers and sailors who'd served in World War II, lynching in the United States was still commonplace, and in fact could be just about as public as a baseball game. When Jackie Robinson took his first steps on a playing field, playing for the Dodger organization, it was in the South, because that's where spring training was, and he would play exhibition games in the South. And death threats were common occurrences, and yet he walked out onto the baseball field, exposing himself not just to beanballs, which were plentiful in his case, not just to people sliding into him at first bases, which is where he began with their spikes high, but literal everyday death threats, because he wanted to accomplish something. And if there's one thing I think I try and do the book, look, so many excellent biographies have been written about Jackie Robinson, books, I must say, which are much more complete than my own. Mine consciously takes a look at a relatively narrow period of time between 1945 and that first year in 1947. I try and bring back an appreciation for Jackie Robinson as an athlete, because it seems to me, at least people of my age have grown up thinking about him as some kind of Gandhian social figure. And he was a jock. This mm-hmm. was a man who was the best and most versatile college athlete of his time. He was a great basketball player. He was a great track star, would have been the odds on favorite to win the decathlon of the Olympic Games in Los Angeles had they not been canceled, because of the onset of World War II. He was a magnificent golfer. Only thing that prevented him from winning intercollegiate golf championships was the fact that, so many courses were segregated.
Do you think, and I often ask this question of, many people who have had huge cultural influences in our society, was Jackie Robinson aware, do you feel, of what the importance was of what he was doing and what he was going through?
This is where the art of the story happens, because he was a jock. He wanted to compete at the highest possible level. That's one of the reasons why it was extraordinary that he banked his temper when he was bid to by Branch Rickey, because he was not accustomed to playing that way on the playing field. He was not, like many jocks, he had been a relatively cosseted athlete in high school and college at Pasadena College and then UCLA. He knew he was there to play sports. He knew the teachers would give him the benefit of the doubt. He'd had a couple of minor scrapes with the law in which he knew the judge let him out because they wanted him to play in the football game on Saturday. And yet, to be thrust into the middle of American social history, he was a man with fine intelligence and a fine sense of conscience, but that's not what made him famous or effective in American life. That begins with the strength in his arms and in legs and his remarkable athletic ability. He understood, once he was inserted into the middle of that, how important his success was to other people. He understood that from the first moment he was signed, and he would come out into the streets of Brooklyn, did right after that first press conference, and see the ways in which African Americans, for that matter, many white Americans, regarded him. Baseball players, any athletes, are so isolated these days. That was less the case when Jackie Robinson was playing. He would get letters in the clubhouse, and in addition to the death threats, most of them were very nice. 90-95% of them were adulatory. And they came from people all over the country, white people and black people, he understood how important his success on the playing field and as a man was to people all over the country. Typically, there were letters that would begin, "Mr. Robinson, I've never written a letter to an athlete before. Mr. Robinson, I thought I didn't like Negroes before." Letters like that. So he had a very shrewd understanding of how important he was to this country. And I think the proof of that is the fact that when he retired from baseball, he really did pick up a second career as a social activist. He became a columnist for newspapers.
Which was something I wasn't aware of until I read your book.
He had some quarrels with Malcolm X and other people in the New York community, became an active Republican, but an independent Republican who, for example, did not endorse Barry Goldwater in 1964. He became an outspoken political and social figure because he understood what the Jackie Robinson story meant to so many people.
Scott Simon's book, Jackie Robinson and the Integration of Baseball, and it's published by Wiley, W-I-L-E-Y, and it is a good book. The whole metaphor of sport and race, and let's kind of fast forward a bit now to the NFL, the NBA, and what is happening in our culture today, where sport oftentimes is described as, you know, the cake and festivities and entertainment for the masses, and perhaps the opiate to satisfy the masses. Has professional sport taken on too big a role in our society today? Also, I do want to retouch the race issue, because like in the NBA, we are seeing fantastic African-American athletes, but still a white ownership pattern.
Well, it's interesting in several things. I think sport certainly occupies too prominent a place in the lives of some individual Americans. As you and I are speaking, George, the National Basketball Association championships are going on, and they are apparently being watched by the smallest audience that has ever watched NBA championships, the series between the New Jersey Nets and the San Antonio Spurs. So if it's an opiate, it's not selling very well at the moment. And it's an interesting fact about the NBA. You know, actually, the African-American percentage in the NBA is declining somewhat because you have so many players coming in from Eastern Europe.
That's true.
And Charles Barkley, for one, not just Charles Barkley, but Charles, obviously be very outspoken, was on our show a number of months ago and talked about how much he liked the Eastern European players because he said they're tough kids. They've come up tough. They have not grown up spoiled like he thinks a lot of, promising basketball player from the age of 12 or 13, Charles believes, probably feels he or she never has to attend class or rarely has to and will be judged by their athletic ability, whereas his, the Eastern European kids are learning the fundamentals of the game and, you know, come from tough societies and have a sense of identification with the game. So I think what's going on there is interesting. Also, at the same time we speak, despite the heavy prominence of African-American stars in the NBA, there is but one authorized African-American owner of an NBA franchise, and of course he hasn't begun yet. That's Bob Johnson. If you take a look in the major sports, that's reflected really in each and every major sport. Baseball, where it must be added the Latin American presence in the game,
very important,
has become so great. There is but one Latin American owner.
Well, as a society, we still have a lot to learn in the area of ethnicity and cultural growth. Again, we're focusing in 25 minutes, 30 minutes here, many important topics. Let's return to NPR and the news cycle of NPR. Now, you do the Saturday news program.
Yes.
And tell us just a bit about your life. Do you work throughout the week here at NPR? Do you come in on Wednesdays? Or how does Scott Simon live and work?
Oh, boy. We work throughout the week on the show. There are, alas, some people that think that I just walk into the studio 7:55 a.m. on a Saturday morning, and that's people will say to me, "Oh, show on Saturday, so what do you do the rest of the week?" We work all week on that show. It's not unlike 60 Minutes. It is NPR's really most heavily listened to. More people listening to our show at any one time than to any other news and information program.
Really?
So it is.
Congratulations.
It's been that way for several years and probably should be. I mean, the listening habits are available on Saturday. As long as we do a good show, knock wood, that should continue to be the case. We're doing something wrong if it's not, because there are a lot of people available then. But because of that, it's a magazine-type show. So we not only offer live breaking coverage of news, but we offer these extended feature pieces, which really have to be put together over a period of time. And they must sound like they've taken a week or more to put together for people to respect them and to be able to connect with them. So we are working on the show throughout the week. I mean, we have been working on what will be next week's show in one way or another for a number of weeks already, trying to position certain pieces to coincide with certain events that we anticipate or certain other pieces that we're going to have on the show. So we habitually will have an editorial meeting on Wednesday in which our producer, Peter Breslow, will kind of pencil in what he thinks we want. The anchor segments, as we call them, which tend to be the last pieces in an hour, those tend to be the most heavily produced pieces or most heavily produced interviews. Then we try and build the show out from that. We rarely know what's going to lead a given hour of the show.
Sure.
We can't, really.
Right.
We can make a guess, obviously, but we can't. And, I mean, I don't mean to make it sound onerous. It's work that we love, and it continues. You know, what's almost the biggest nag at the back of my brain every week is this weekly essay I write.
Well, it's interesting because that is the part of the program among many parts, but your essays, to me, are so well done, well written. In fact, in years past, you won a Peabody for your essays. And
I never stop thinking about what I might have to write an essay about. And it must be said, rarely the idea you have on Tuesday persists to the weekend. Because I also think those things have to be topical. And those essays come right after we review the news with Dan Shore, which is done live. And so my essays have to be as topical as anything that Dan is saying. Sometimes we use them to fill in something in the coverage. Sometimes we use them to reflect on something else in the coverage. I also have a feeling that I probably shouldn't be, with the exception of war or catastrophe, I probably shouldn't be serious more than 3 weeks in a row. I also probably shouldn't be funny more than 2 weeks in a row.
Is there a special relationship between you and Dan Shore? Because it sounds like it.
Oh, yeah, there is.
Oh,
I mean,
great.
I was scared to death when I first began to work with him. As I think probably, let me look around the control room, probably a great many people probably still are.
Does he appreciate that fear? No, I'm kidding.
Sure. I think he appreciates it. But he's actually always been very nice to me. And we've grown very close over the years, spent Thanksgiving together.
And you to him, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, Scott Simon of National Public Radio, it's been a pleasure. I have enjoyed your professional work for years, and it's nice to get to know you better.
Well, nice talking to you, George. Thank you.
The interview with Scott Simon was recorded mid-June at National Public Radio in Washington, D.C., and this is George Cole for Yellowstone Public Radio. Thank you for listening.